The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Dr. Eugene Zamperon, your host, for this very fascinating edition, and we have one of the superstars in natural medicine as our guest here. We have Dr. David Brady. Dr. Brady is a licensed naturopathic physician and board-certified clinical nutritionist. He's the vice provost of the Division of Health Sciences and the director of human nutrition and an associate professor at the University of Bridgeport. He also is chief medical officer and product formulation for Designs of Health, and he's a technical consultant for Metametrics Clinical Labs, and he also, in his spare time, maintains a private practice specializing in functional medicine. And he's also been an author of numerous books and professional publications, and including his Healthy Revolution, What You Really Need to Know to Stay Healthy in a Sick World. It is a sick world. How you doing, Dave? Nice to hear. Nice to have you on.
Hey, Dr. Z. How are you doing? Great to be on again.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Listen, before we get started, tell us a little bit about the University of Bridgeport. People don't know that it's a real progressive hub for many different types of medicine, and people may be interested in a career in that particular genre.
Sure, yeah. The University of Bridgeport is really a unique place in that we have, we're really the only university system in the country that has a blend, really, of more conventional or standard medical programs and also integrative and complementary or alternative programs as well. So within the same Division of Health Sciences, we have a CNME-accredited naturopathic medical school. We have a chiropractic college, but we also have a physician assistant program and a dental hygiene program. We have an acupuncture program. We have a great master's in human nutrition program, for instance, that we have available not only on campus but online from the nutritional standpoint. And we have a lot of doctors all over the world, really, in academic centers of excellence in medicine that are alumni of the University of Bridgeport's programs, particularly the Human Nutrition Institute.
And how does someone get more information on UB there?
Well, I think the easiest thing is to just visit bridgeport.edu. That's the university's website. And there's tons of information on the different academic programs, the different choices for training. We cater to not only people in programs that come back full-time for 4 years with an internship and residency, but we also have programs, like I said, that are available online or only on weekends in nutrition, acupuncture, and the like. Our new physician assistant program is the only one in the country, for instance, that has a integrative medicine component built within the curriculum itself. So it's a really cool, innovative place. We have a great public clinic system called the UB Clinics. You can learn more about that at ubclinics.org. And we provide treatment in all these modalities for people all over the Northeast region. We've really become a center of excellence for truly integrative healthcare, not just integrative healthcare by name. A lot of centers have a so-called integrative healthcare center, but they really don't offer that much beyond standard orthodox treatment. We do. We have a really nice blend of really comprehensive integrative medicine offerings.
Great. Thank you for that. Now, I know you speak quite widely at various integrative medical conferences around the world, and one of the things I remember when I was, actually when you were in one of my classes, we talked about this. And of course you knew this before because you came in to the naturopathic program as a doctor of chiropractic already and had a strong background in nutrition. But you know, the old saying, when in doubt, treat the gut. I mean, it sounds like an old-fashioned thing, but why is the GI system so important to your overall health?
Well, you know, you can go back to all of the sort of older, learned, more established approaches to healthcare, if you will, throughout the world, whether it's traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, which you're very knowledgeable in, shamanic medicine. It doesn't matter where you go. They've all pretty much come to the conclusion that when the gastrointestinal system is not healthy, the person or the organism will just simply not be healthy. It'll pull it down. And that's not a concept that is entirely foreign in Western medicine. For instance, the Nobel laureate and great Russian pathologist Metchnikoff is quoted as saying back in the turn of the 20th century that death begins in the colon. And although it took a while for that really to take on steam here in orthodox medicine, it really is. If you look at the research out there, it's becoming more and more clear that if you have suboptimal gastrointestinal health and a gastrointestinal environment, which is a very complex environment, with lots of different bacteria, in fact, 75% of our immune system is based in the gut. The gut has its own separate and operating nervous system called the enteric nervous system. It's the only system of the body or organ that has its own independent nervous system. So that tells you that the body is putting a lot of emphasis and importance on what's going on in that gastrointestinal environment. Because if it's not right, the organism simply will not be right. And now we see in the medical literature a lot of linkage between gastrointestinal disorders and systemic medical problems, particularly autoimmune diseases, but it even goes beyond that, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of those relationships through our discussion today.
Absolutely. So what can go wrong with the gut? We are a society that likes to stop at Mickey D's for a quick meal. We kind of don't even chew it. We inhale it. There's all kinds of Dr. Null just did a whole show on GMO foods, and the big issues around that. We have all kinds of antibiotics in the food stuff that are, I guess, altering the way we digest food. Our gut is kind of like a big bioreactive system, I would assume. You'll talk about that. So what's happening with the gut? And talk about the different imbalances that can happen in this modern society.
Well, all of the things you mentioned certainly play a major role. It's not too far of a intellectual stretch to know that the food choices that you make every day, you're putting the food substance directly in your gut. So if you put garbage in, you're going to get a garbage outcome. If you put good, healthy, vibrant stuff in, you're going to get a much better outcome. Genetically modified foods, chemicals in the foods and preservatives and all the Western science foods, I call them, foods in a package, foods that the food industry got their dirty little hands on, are not good for us. And, that's a no-brainer. But the problem goes well beyond that. The gut is such a complex place. The gastrointestinal system is really outside of our body. Even though it runs through the middle of our body, it's technically outside of our body. And it's a different environment all to itself. And it's a very complex one. There's over 100 trillion bacteria in the human gut. 100 trillion.
Wow.
Even in the days of bailouts, that's still a big number.
That's
a big number.
More stars than in the galaxy or several galaxies, that's for sure.
Yeah, you're right. There are more, microbes in one human's intestinal tract than there are known stars in the galaxy, and that number exceeds all other cells in your body, which means you have more bacteria in your gut than you have cells that make up your body.
Wow.
And the gut, like I said, is really trying to keep tabs on all of that. In fact, for instance, in the small intestine alone, there's over 100 million nerve cells, which exceeds the number of neurons in the spinal cord, for instance. And most people don't realize that. This whole enteric nervous system, which is independent from our brain and, our central and peripheral nervous system, it's just this gut nervous system. And it's the architecture of it is very much like a tubular organism, like a sea worm, basically. And it's kind of this independent operating little system within our body, which is made up of a tremendous amount of surface area for which we're exposed to this outside environment filled with bacteria and toxins and potential antigenic proteins. In fact, if you took the intestines out of a human and just squashed them down one cell layer thick, you would have about the size of a regulation tennis court. So that's how much exposure and surface area we have to these 100 trillion organisms that are all producing metabolites and toxins and poisons. Then we have to have an immune system that kind of tolerates the bacteria, the fungi, and even the parasites that we want to live in us, and is reactive and has a defense against those that we don't. And that's a really fine balance. And when that fine balance between what's called oral tolerance, meaning, you know, we accept the organisms we want in that environment, but we repel the organisms we don't, when that gets out of balance, we basically develop autoimmune disease, and we can talk about why that happens a little later. But we know that gastrointestinal systems that are unhealthy are related to, for instance, Hashimoto's thyroiditis and Graves' disease of the thyroid, rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, multiple sclerosis, any kind of autoimmune disease you can think of, including type 1 diabetes, it's related to poor gut function.
And that's the term dysbiosis. They sort of coined that, I guess, maybe 15 or so years ago.
Yeah, dysbiosis just simply means a improper balance or ecology in the gut, meaning that you don't have the proper types and balances and relative levels of bacteria, fungi, yeast, and even parasites that you should in a normal, healthy gut. When your gut is normal and healthy, it's termed orthobiosis, and that was a term also coined by Metchnikoff, who I mentioned just previously at the turn of the last century. But dysbiosis is a term that was really brought back, and a lot of these concepts that we're talking about today about the gut being so important to the person globally is really a tenet that's come out of the modern functional medicine movement. However, it's now being accepted and researched heavily in the most standard or orthodox gastroenterology and rheumatology and immunology literature that there is out there.
Well, these guys don't talk to each other. It's kind of interesting. You know, you don't usually see you go to a rheumatologist. I know I do quite a bit of that work, as you know, and they're not talking to a gastroenterologist, and they're not certainly talking to an immunologist, and they're certainly not talking to somebody that's involved in the endocrine system, looking at the adrenals and the whole steroidal biochemistry. So you have this very interesting model that you're working with, Dr. Brady, that, you know, various multi-disciplines are linking all these things together with the wellness of the body, and that's kind of unprecedented.
Yeah, but it has to happen. You know, Dr. Z, we know it has to happen. Patients now know it has to happen. We just have to convince all of these high-dollar specialists in orthodox medicine that it has to happen, because the outcomes are not good. You know, there's direct evidence in the medical literature, and it's emerging day by day, for instance, in the management of autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, and thyroid disorders, Graves, Hashimoto's, and, you know, lupus and MS and everything else, that there are really definable problems that are occurring in those patients' gastrointestinal tracts, and they generally have overgrowth of specific organisms, in many cases bacteria, that we know are directly associated with that disease. For instance, there's a bacteria called Klebsiella that overgrows in people with inflammatory joint-related diseases that are autoimmune, like rheumatoid arthritis and ankylosing spondylitis. In Hashimoto's and Graves' disease of the thyroid, we know that a bug called Yersinia overgrows. And we know that there's overgrowth in general of Proteus and E. coli and a bunch of other stuff in autoimmune diseases, and that they really are the genesis of the abnormal immune response, which then causes the body to attack itself. And it's a little bit complicated, but it's really a phenomenon, if anyone's interested, known as molecular mimicry. And what that means is one molecule mimics another enough to where the immune system can no longer discriminate or tell the difference between the two. And when you get an overgrowth of a certain bacteria in the intestine, when the intestine is not in a healthy state, the immune system makes antibodies to bind onto proteins based on that protein structure on this organism. Now, those proteins on these organisms can be very similar to protein receptors on the surface of certain body tissues. For instance, when this bug Yersinia overgrows in the GI tract, the body makes antibodies to bind to the protein receptors on Yersinia. Those protein receptors are very similar to the TSH receptors on the thyroid gland. So your body's making these antibodies to combat this bacteria in the gut, which is what it should do. But if the person's inflamed and they're genetically susceptible, then this little bit of a difference between these two protein receptors is no longer appreciated, and those antibodies bind to the TSH receptor on the thyroid, telling your immune system that the thyroid is not you. It's essentially this bacteria, and it needs to be attacked and destroyed.
So it's like camouflage. It's the way insects and many other organisms try to camouflage themselves, like a leaf hopper would hide and pretend he was green to hide from a bird predating. So when the bacteria mimic or camouflage themselves to look like the joint tissue or the heart tissue or the thyroid tissue, that's problems, you're saying.
Yeah, it's big problems. And whether they're doing that as a tactic from a survival standpoint to look enough like us to where we don't attack them, or whether it's just simply circumstance or coincidence that one protein looks enough like another, the body can't discriminate, we don't know yet. For instance, in type 1 diabetes, it's interesting medically when you learn about that when you're in medical school that, you know, here's this person, they're young and healthy and they're doing fine, and all of a sudden one day when they're a juvenile, they fall down and they're unconscious and they get taken to the emergency department and they find out their glucose is, you know, 600.
Yeah.
How did they go from being healthy one day to passing out the next? Well, now we know there's a molecular mimicry that these folks can have something that triggers an immune response that very rapidly destroys the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. And one of the biggest triggers that we've identified through the research is a certain peptide or protein that occurs in cow's milk in genetically susceptible children, not all children, not all people, but when these people are fed cow's milk through their childhood, they're developing these antibodies against this protein that they're not compatible with. And it gets to a critical point where it crosses over a threshold, and then those things start binding to the islet cells in the pancreas, and they rapidly destroy them, and then they're rendered diabetic, and it happens very quickly. That's a dramatic example of it, but it occurs in many of these different disorders to different triggers, and the triggers are not only bacterial. They can be viral. They can also be food proteins. We know, for instance, that people with celiac disease, which is an inflammatory bowel disorder related to intolerance to gluten, gliadin-containing wheats, or gluten and gliadin-containing grains, including wheat, rye, barley, and the like, we know that they have about 10 to 20 times the rate of autoimmune thyroid diseases like Hashimoto's and Graves. And it turns out that the antibodies formed to gluten and gliadin in people who are genetically susceptible to that intolerance, we know that those antigen antibody complexes can bind to the thyroid. They can also bind into the central nervous system and not only cause autoimmune thyroid disorders, but early dementia, degenerative neurological conditions, and the like. So we're just starting to make these associations, and functional medicine doctors look at this stuff and try to put it into play every day in their practices, where if someone comes in with an autoimmune thyroid condition, we do a stool analysis. We look for the DNA of Yersinia and these other organisms.
Yeah.
If they come in with rheumatoid arthritis, we're looking for Klebsiella and Citrobacter. We're doing food sensitivity testing to see if they're incompatible with things that they're eating. And if that's the case, we remove those offending agents that fuel the fire and calm the patient's autoimmune disease down. This simply doesn't happen when they go to a conventional rheumatologist, let's say because they have rheumatoid arthritis, or an endocrinologist when they have Hashimoto's or Graves' disease. They don't get stool analysis. They don't get food sensitivity testing. They don't even get sent to the gastroenterologist. It's like that these worlds are entirely separate and over-specialized, and the medical literature is very clear on this. But, you know, that I really feel, Dr. Z, and I think you're probably with me on this, that American and Western medical research is top-notch. It's incredibly advanced and very good and rock-solid. The problem is that what we learn from that research rarely translates, and it never translates rapidly to the practice of medicine, which I think is really bogged down in politics, dogma, economics, and these sort of standards of care that are very regimented, almost cookbook-like prescriptions. And unfortunately, the physicians are so busy, they're not able to read this literature and then kind of try it in practice as long as they're not going to hurt somebody. They're afraid to deviate from the orthodoxy, and the only time that they will benefit from the research and then put it into play, unfortunately, is when, usually when a big pharma house looks at this literature or funds the literature and then develops a molecule that acts on that pathway, and they send out their detail people to tell the physicians, hey, when you see this, use this drug. And we have to do better than that. We just have to.
I've never seen, like you said, a rheumatologist or whatnot doing a stool analysis. Now, you know, you go, and even if they did, they probably would send the stool to, you know, Quest Lab or a conventional medical
right.
lab who'd be looking for, you know, Shigella and
right,
Campylobacter.
Right, just the diarrhea-producing organisms. You're right. They wouldn't get the right kind of testing at all.
So tell us about that testing. Like, what would be the way that you as a functional medicine doc would work up someone's bowel, and tell us about the various types of stool tests that are out there?
Well, in functional medicine, you know, we use a much more comprehensive type of stool analysis than the standard, you know, medical stool analysis, which is really designed simply to hunt for pathogenic or very virulent organisms that might set up in the gut and cause diarrhea and fulminant infections. We're looking more for subtle shifts in what's known as the microbiota, the makeup of the different organisms within the GI tract. And we're particularly looking for some of these organisms that the medical research has clearly defined for us as being, you know, molecular mimicry type of triggers for autoimmune disease and other kinds of problems. And the best way to do that at this point, there's really new emerging techniques in science that are now at our disposal, in that we don't any longer just, you know, get a stool analysis and they use a microbial technique where they just put it on a plate and they let stuff grow and they try to determine what organism it is by feeding it some different sugars and seeing what it looks like. And it's just not a great, super sensitive and specific way to do it. And it only deals with a small number of the bacteria in the gut, which are aerobes that can live in oxygen. Now we have much better tools. We have PCR DNA based techniques where we really hunt for the genes at the genetic level of these different organisms. The sample collection is much easier. The organisms do not even have to be alive, so they're dropped in formalin by the patient in a little tube, sent back to the lab, and we get very, very specific and precise analysis of what kind of bugs are there, the good bugs, the bad bugs, and the bugs in between. And that includes bacteria, fungi, parasites, and the like. And we can really assess the GI ecology and optimize it for these patients as part of improving their health. And with that, with the stool analysis, we have inflammatory markers, immunological markers. We can look, for instance, at something called anti-gliadin secretory IgA. We're looking for subtle intolerance to gluten and gliadin-containing grains that would never be picked up in many cases on standard medical workup for, let's say, celiac disease. So in functional medicine, as the name implies, we're looking for different levels of functionality, not just if there's overt pathology or not. And they're two very different models. And for chronic disease, I would really submit that the functional model works much, much better. You know, orthodox medicine is really good at a lot of things. They're great at trauma and acute medical issues, infectious disease and things like that. But with chronic care, and we've seen this, diabetes and chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia and rheumatoid arthritis and right on down the line, obesity, metabolic syndrome, there's a lot to be desired, because that acute medical care model doesn't really, where it's one cause, you know, one disease, one cause, one symptom, doesn't really work very well. You really need to take what's called a systems biology approach, where we really investigate someone's unique biochemistry and metabolism and try to put together all the pieces in the mosaic of why they might be chronically ill. And, you know, that's a different model. It takes more than a 4 to 6 minute office visit. But it can be done.
Yeah, there's so many people that fall through the cracks, so to speak, that have just a myriad. They come in with 20, 30, 40 symptoms. And
yep.
To a doctor who is, you know, one symptom or several symptoms match it to a pharmaceutical, they're either going to walk out with, you know, 20 or 30 pharmaceuticals to intervene on those symptomology, or go to a functional medicine doctor or naturopathic physician or whatnot, and then look for the link between these myriad of seemingly unrelated symptoms, just like we talked about. People have neurological things when they have gut problems. Tell us about the typical patient that comes in with, you know, these a myriad of these issues that you see in your office. So give us a couple of cases that might be
fascinating. Well, in functional medicine, Dr. Z, rather than, you know, really get hung up on every single symptom that they name, and I think that's kind of what standard medicine often, that's the trap they fall into. Like you said, a patient comes in with long-standing chronic disorders. You know, the typical patient, let's say, I don't know, a 45-year-old female was really under lots of stress for the last 10 or 15 years, you know, oftentimes raising kids, trying to work, trying to be everyone's caretaker.
Right.
They come in, they complain of fatigue, alternating gas and diarrhea and bloating. They're allergic to a lot of things. They have body aches all over. Mm. You know, they have irregular menstrual cycles. They have dermatological problems. You know, just the
insomnia.
Symptoms go on and
right, insomnia,
yeah, insomnia,
that's a big one,
mild
too.
Depression,
yeah.
And,
yeah.
And anxiety or panic attacks,
right.
And you know, you just sit there and list them out and list them out, and you know what could happen is they go to a standard physician who's really not trained to deal with all of those things at one time. So they either are given a long list of medications to modulate those individual symptoms that they talked about, or it's, you know, it's chalked up to just sort of hysteria, and they're given an antidepressant or something. And that's not fair. These patients
right.
really do have real problems, but it's just a complicated thing where you have to sit down, and instead of chasing individual symptoms, you got to look for commonality, and you got to treat from the foundation up. It's like if you have a house that's really a wreck, you can't just, you know, straighten the roof or put a little paint on it here and there. You got to work from the foundation up. And one of the foundations of functional medicine is making sure that the gastrointestinal system is in good shape, it's optimal, and it's sound, that the patient has good detoxification and liver function, that if they're pro-inflammatory, that you work with them from a diet and lifestyle standpoint to lower their inflammatory potential, and you stabilize their immune response and their stress response. A lot of this comes down to excessive stress, excessive inflammation, poor diet, poor lifestyles, too much sedentary, lack of activity, I should say, and you really need to work it from there. And there are various investigational test we use to try to determine what this unique individual in front of us really needs. So we use things like organic acid or metabolic profile testing. We use these stool analyses. We use these different things in conjunction with standard medical tests to really try to put the whole picture together.
So let's talk about the organic acid, because I know you do a lot of work with that. Now, that's sort of like the analogy of how at the motor vehicle department, they stick the thing up the car's tailpipe and examine the fumes given off by the car, and they can thus diagnose the issues with the engine and exhaust, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not unlike that. I know you take a urine sample, and it's sent off to the lab, and from that urine sample, they can glean many, many systems. Discuss how that happens.
Yeah, it is a time. It's an overnight and first morning urine sample, so everyone relax. We don't have to put anything up anybody's tailpipe.
Exactly. Maybe later on. No, I'm only joking.
Yeah.
If they need colonics. No, just joking. But
yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. But organic acid testing is really sort of akin to what the blood chemistry and complete blood count is in standard diagnostic medicine. Through the urine, we can look at a whole spectrum of different metabolites that are coming out of the body that are direct ashes or indicative of what's going on in really key metabolic or biochemical pathways. And by comparing not only the levels that you put out versus, you know, quote-unquote normal people, but looking at the level of one metabolite versus another metabolite versus another metabolite, we can start making a profile of how efficient you are in critical biochemical reactions and which enzymes are performing well, which enzymes are not performing well. And most of the enzymes in the body that are driving critical reactions are dependent on, for instance, vitamins, minerals, and other cofactors to perform. So we might be able to detect specific enzymatic problems, or what we call metabolic lesions in an individual, and we know which nutrient, for instance, to give them to push that pathway harder. And many of these things are genetic, you know, individual uniquenesses that we have in our biochemistry. And these tests look at biochemical reactions and metabolic pathways related to some of these key foundational elements, like how well do your cells in the mitochondria of the cell make energy? Are you a good energy producer or not? And if not, where are the problems? How can we help? It looks, for instance, at how well you detoxify, not only toxins that you are exposed to from the outside, but toxins that you generate internally. Mm-hmm. So it looks at critical hepatic or liver detoxification biochemistry. It looks at how much oxidative stress you're under and how much damage to the DNA that you're taking. We actually look at chemical evidence of damage to the guanine bases. The guanosine bases of the DNA. That's very, very specific to the individual. We look at evidence of overgrowth of bacteria and yeast and other organisms in the GI tract. We look at critical neurotransmitters to determine, do you have a healthy, vibrant, or overactive stress response? And that's just an example. We look at a lot of things. We can look very quickly through little blood spot tests at your fatty acid balance and are your tissues pro-inflammatory or not. We can look at amino acid levels, which are precursors to neurotransmitters and hormones and the like. So we can look at food IgG food sensitivities. We can do a lot of different things with very quick, very inexpensive, non-invasive testing at this point, and really tailor programs to the individual to kind of rebuild them from the foundation up.
How powerful is it to give someone a report like that and tell them that they're actually damaging their DNA and that their life choices, they're not taking enough antioxidants, that they're not making enough ATP, which is a human fuel, which drives all the cells. I know there's plenty of patients out there that have syndrome X or diabetes. What do they say? One out of every three people down the road in 10 years are going to have diabetes or some ridiculous number like that.
Well, it was just in USA Today,
right.
I think, on Friday. Yeah.
Terrible. So, I mean, and if you can actually tell them what they're missing or what's the problem and what needs to be done, what a powerful tool that can motivate patients.
Well, it is powerful because a lot of these patients, go to their standard physician and they get a regular blood chemistry panel that's meant to look for overt disease, not for these subtle changes in metabolism and biochemistry. And they're basically told, well, you don't feel very well, but your lab tests are all normal, so I guess there's nothing wrong with you. And, that's not the case. It's just that the test that they're using is really not meant to look at what they need to look at.
I call it leave it to beaver medicine. Those tests are, came out of favor in the 1950s, Dr. Brady. And now we have more sophisticated testing, like you mentioned, in the DNA stool testing, the organic acids, looking at stress and cortisol and the whole relationship between those things and allergies and whatnot. Let's talk a little bit about autoimmune disease for a few more minutes, because that's something that I'm fascinated in. Now, how actually, you go to the average rheumatologist, Dr. Brady, and they say still, we don't know the cause of arthritis, of rheumatoid arthritis. We don't know the cause. It's mysterious. Let's just give you medicines to turn off your immune system so you stop attacking yourself, whether it's a biological response modifier like Enbrel or Remicade or Humira, these types of drugs, or the old standbys, gold, methotrexate, Plaquenil, these types of drugs, lots of NSAIDs, turn off the pain, and that's how we have to manage, because we don't really know what's causing it, This is sort of what walks in my office, I know, and I'm sure yourself as well. Can you comment on those patients? Because they come and they're very confused because the doctor, an esteemed rheumatologist that they're putting their faith into, is telling them, just take these medications. We don't know what's the cause. And then we in functional medicine say, well, we can actually identify multiple causes of these illnesses.
Yeah, I mean, you see it from both ways. A lot of these patients are, really suffering a lot of the times, and the rheumatologists and the doctors are trying to offer them, something, some agent that'll help them feel better and gain more level of functionality in the short term, and that's appropriate in many cases, but I think it can't stop there. You know, it has to dig deeper than that, and I think that's not always done, because the way you have to work it up, it takes time. It doesn't fit with the American insurance-based medical model, which is about a six-minute office visit, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
This takes more time, and it's not as easy as just flipping someone a pill to get down at the pharmacist. You got to talk to them. You got to spend time with them. You got to figure out, what stresses they're under, what their lifestyle's like. You got to talk to them about everything from their activity levels to their diet. And getting into issues of diet and things is very difficult with patients in that kind of model. And it doesn't sell pharmaceuticals. So, unfortunately, like it or not, I'm not one of these conspiracy theory people at all. But Big Pharma has a major, major stranglehold on the American and Western medical system. And, that's not always a bad thing. I wouldn't want to live in a world without pharmaceutical choices and interventions. But it can't be the only thing. And that really is the money driver in the whole system. And it really permeates down through the academic training of physicians, through their experiences in residency. And basically, if it's not a pharmacological or surgical option, they just don't learn about it. And they're really deterred from investigating it unless they really want to step outside of the medical model and the orthodoxy, which more and more physicians are doing.
Right.
But it's just a different way of doing it, and it's unfortunate that it has to be separate, but right now it is.
And so patients will come to your office, and you might say, we need to look at your diet, your shopping habits, when you're eating, how much you're eating, are you taking digestive enzymes, which they don't even know about. Most doctors treat digestive disorders by turning off the digestive system instead of turning it on like we do in naturopathic medicine. I find that just fascinating. And then how about the recent information that there are certain probiotics seem to work with certain people? And talk about probiotics a little, Dr. Brady, because I think that's one of those, what we call the 4R program of our way that we deal with the digestive problems in functional medicine. So the first R is to rid the body of the toxic food, the toxic lectins in the food, the other types of things, the gliadin and gluten that you mentioned, toxic bacteria, virus, and yeast and whatnot. And then we're helping strengthen the digestive processes, which is not even done in medicine at all. They actually turn the whole digestive system off. And then we have, repopulate and then regenerate the digestive system with certain, botanicals and other types of fascinating medicines. Lactoferrin comes to mind and other things like that, whey. And talk about the 4R program, because I know that's the hallmark of how we would deal with the GI.
Well, yeah, the functional medicine approach to GI problems, you can kind of summarize it a little bit. I mean, it's a little oversimplification,
yeah, sure.
But the 4 R's, remove the offending agents. They can be offending foods that you're sensitive to or just the foods that are bad for you in general. Remove the bacteria and fungi, yeast, parasites that are pathogenic or opportunistic and shouldn't be there. And then you want to replace things, with good foods, with anti-inflammatory foods, with whole fresh foods, we replace enzymes, for instance, in those who have enzymatic deficiency or hydrochloric acid deficiency. And then the third R is reinoculate or repopulate. That's where we try to put in higher levels of the good bacteria, the pro and prebiotics and the fibers and things like that. And then the final R is repair. We try to repair the damage that's been done. A lot of times the gastrointestinal lining or mucosa is left in an inflamed, erosed state. People have a condition called leaky gut syndrome or hyperpermeability, which allows toxins and potential allergenic proteins to translate through the gut in a very fast fashion before those proteins or antigens are digested properly or dealt with immunologically at the level of the gut. And that can lead to people being sensitive or allergic or intolerant to a whole spectrum of foods. It can lead to inflammation. It can lead to autoimmune disease. So we try to, deal with it from a multifactorial standpoint of not only getting rid of the bad stuff, giving the good stuff, repairing the tissues, and taking a comprehensive approach to it. And probiotics is just one part of that, therapeutic regimen, but probiotics are amazing things. I mean, they're being studied extensively at the highest levels of gastroenterology and immunology right now. It's really somewhat of a mystery why they're not being used across the board in standard orthodox medicine, because they're all over the standard orthodox medical research.
Yeah.
With evidence showing that they're beneficial in inflammatory bowel diseases, from everything from that, from I was just reading a study on probiotics and counseling in pregnant women results in much better body composition and weight loss and after pregnancy, that these women do not end up being obese after they're pregnant. Probiotics are signal agents. They create all kinds of cellular messages that are good messages in the body.
Weren't you saying something in one of your papers I was reading that obesity and weight gain and things like that may have to do with a bowel bacteria?
Well, it's not one bacteria. There are two major genera or phyla, I should say, of bacteria. And people have different balances of these major levels of organisms. And you have the Firmicutes and the Bacteroides. And basically, there's about an 80-20% ratio in most people. Most people have 80% of organisms that would fall under the broad category of Firmicutes, and about 20% that would be under the Bacteroides. And researchers have seen that if you go way above, if you start going above 80% Firmicutes bugs, you tend to be obese. And if the ratio is on the other side, less than 80% Firmicutes, then you tend to be thinner. And they noticed this in animal models first. They researched it in mice. They brought it over to humans, and it worked. That they basically took sterile mice, for instance, and they put the GI bacteria from obese mice into them, or the GI bacteria from thin mice into the same sterile mice, and they gave them the same diet, same exercise level. The sterile or knockout mice that got the fat bugs from the obese GI tracts got obese on the same diet, and the ones that got the bacteria from the thin mice stayed thin. So they kept trying to research that, and basically what it is different bacteria have different levels of efficiency at us helping us digest food and helping us actually bring calories from the food into the body, basically, or extract the calories from the body, because bacteria help us digest various carbohydrates, starches, and the like in food that we don't have the enzymes to break down. So if we have more of the bacteria that are efficient calorie extractors, we get more calories from the same amount of food. So by altering the gut microbiology, we can actually help people's body composition and help them be leaner.
That's amazing. That is, I think, one of the most stellar things I've ever read that looks at
probiotics. Really, yeah, and
probiotics.
It's not the panacea to weight loss, but it's part of the puzzle. You know.
Well, you wonder if there's ever a link, and I'm going to start asking patients that. You know, did they notice that they started to gain weight after they got on a lot of antibiotics, or they had massive changes in their food, having lots of unorganic meat or sugar binges or all the things that you kind of talked about that could actually either feed the abnormal bacteria and create this dysbiosis or imbalance. Fascinating. Well,
yep.
Tell us a little bit about where we can get in contact with you. I'm looking at the time, and it's 5 minutes to the hour, so we need to wrap up Dr. Brady. So tell us a little bit about where people can hear you speak or read your books or get on top of your website and certainly get in touch with you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Z. My website is just drdavidbrady.com, so DrDavidBrady, drdavidbrady.com. That is information on myself. It has a schedule of seminars and events and conferences I'll be speaking at through the next year. It has information on my private clinical practice, and it has links out to the University of Bridgeport's clinics. in the University of Bridgeport's academic programs. You can visit bridgeport.edu for information on our academic programs and the UB clinics, ubclinics.org for information on our clinics. My practice is in Trumbull, Connecticut, which is in Fairfield County near Fairfield, Connecticut, and it's called Whole Body Medicine, and you can hit that at wholebodymed.com.
Wonderful.
And thanks for having me on. I love talking about this and giving people information to be their own health advocates, because unfortunately they have to navigate this maze of our medical system, and a lot of times if they don't drive the process, they won't get the right things done.
Great. Well, thanks again, and we'll have you on again at some other point. Stay in touch and be well. And
that's pleasure, Dr. Z. I will add that you're one of our prize faculty members here at the University of Bridgeport, so we appreciate everything you do.
Oh, great. I'm glad we got the word out about UB, a wonderful program and place to study here. And that does it for the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Z, for this edition. Stay well, folks. Bye-bye.